Okay, well, comrades, I've been asked to speak on what is money. I'm going to try and keep it relatively short. Maybe we can take it through with questions and discussion. Well, there it is. It's a bit sad. It's only a fiver. The first thing to say about it, it's no use to man or beast, is it? I mean, this as it stands, it only has one use in that you can get things that are useful with it. Like, if I'm not mistaken, you probably get about 40, 50 pence change from the chip shop, for fish and chips. And none of the pubs around here look that enticing. But having said that, I reckon you'd probably run to about 2 pints of beer with a fiver. So what we're actually talking about is not about money, because money is just a means of swapping. It's useless, but it's a means of swapping things about that are useful to us. This is a gross simplification, and I'm going to spend quite a lot of time qualifying it, but let's just start like that. Money is no use to us. It's just a way of swapping things around that are of use to us. So what we're actually interested in is value. You know, why 2 pints of beer are about the same as fish and chips, and why both of those things cost very much less than a house, and both of them cost a great deal more than a box of matches. Okay? So that's value. Now, the problem is actually a capitalist economy, just to tell you what I'm going to tell you. And that is that in any form of society, we have a division of labour. The word economics comes from a Greek word, oikonomia, which means household management. And the point about a household is it might be organised democratically or it might be organised autocratically, but it is organised. It is planned. Somebody says, we need this, this, this and this, and this is what we've got to go out and get it. You've got to do this, you've got to do that. You do the washing up. All those sort of decisions are arrived at somehow in quite a conscious way. And under capitalism, it is unique that nobody actually decides that. I mean, you are part of the grand scheme of things. We're going to have a discussion tomorrow. I think nearly all of you are going to be there, where you find out that there are subprime mortgages, that Joe and Josephine Soap in Peoria in southern Illinois find out that their mortgage has been sold on to some bloke in a bank called Northern Rock in a town called Newcastle in a place called England that they've never heard of. That's a world division of labour, but it's not a conscious world division of labour. Nobody says that that's going to take place. So therefore prices are mysterious, and we know they're important to us. That they decide whether your quality of life, what your standard of living is going to be. But people don't actually understand them. But we go beyond money and we start with the commodity. That's what Marx started with, the commodity. A commodity is two things. It's a useful object, like fish and chips, and also it's got something else about it. It must be exchangeable for something else, such as 2 pints of beer. Now, obviously, if you look at 2 pints of beer and fish and chips, there is absolutely no physical way that you compare them. You can't weigh them or measure them or anything like that and work out how they're the same in any way whatsoever. So what is the same about them? There must be something the same about them if they're being compared. It's social. It's not a natural phenomenon. And Marx calls it value or exchange value. And in effect, what is happening is that both of these commodities, fish and chips and 2 pints of beer, are part of a huge global division of labour, and part of the pool of labour which is available to us, like one vast household consisting of more than 6 billion people, is actually being allocated to the production of pints of beer on the one hand and fish and chips on the other hand. So a commodity is both a useful object, which Marx calls a use value, and it's also an exchange value. Okay? And that common thing that they both have in common is that they are both properties of human labour. They're part of the pool of labour which is available to us. Now, Marx started off with a more boring example, which was about 20 yards of linen equals one coat. He went through this. And what happened was in the exchange is that one is used as the measure of the other. You go through different forms of value, what are called the relative and the equivalent form. You're saying, oh, well, let's use a coat and measure other things. Oh, well, a coat is equal to 20 yards of linen. And it's also equals to this this amount of snuff, I think various other 19th century examples he uses. All these things are equal. And they're equal because they have equal quantities of labour embodied in them. On average, we'll qualify that later on. But labour is the only common substance that these things have about them. There's nothing physical about them. And that's what they have in common. But the point is that the coat or the linen or whatever it is being used as a basis to work out what other things are worth to us. So in other words, it's being used as a primitive money form. From going to the equivalent form of value, 20 yards of linen equals one coat, which you're doing as a one-off swap to start off with. When exchange becomes generalised, you're going to be doing this on a regular basis. You're going to be drawing a whole schedule of things that are equal to one coat. Now you can see, so the point is you never actually work out how much labour is embodied in a thing directly. You're just saying it's equal to this. It's some of you know the terminology, it's ordinal, not cardinal. You're not actually measuring the amount of labour. Oh, there's probably 36 and a half labour hours in that one, directly and indirectly. Because if you imagine it, even working out quite a simple thing like a coat, probably starts off with some Welsh hill farmer, you know, breeding sheep, and then somebody making plastic. It's really quite complicated working out the amount of labour that goes into a production of even such a straightforward thing as a coat. You know, because the button manufacturing machine, presumably there's a little bit of depreciation every time they pop the button off, but I bet there's people in some back street place that go for years and years and years, you know, like us lot with our printing equipment, with obsolescent button making machines. Actually working the depreciation out on of a button making machine would be quite, how much of it goes into an individual button would really be quite hard. Now, we're using a coat measure of value. Now, I think you can see right away what the problems of a coat measure of value are. What about 5 yards of linen? What are we going to do? Sort of cut one of the sleeves off and say that's the same as that? It's not very practical, is it? So you have two problems. You have, first of all, you have to have something that you can sort of cut up into finite bits, so you can measure all sorts of different other things that are around. And precious metals naturally went that way because you could melt them down. You could have big lumps of gold or silver and small lumps of gold and silver. The other thing is it has to be a thing that's fairly generally wanted. I mean, it appears that the first trading peoples were pastoralists, you know, people who bred cattle and stuff like that and wandered around and exchanged cows with people for other things. Now you can see the problem with that. I mean, you can't really cut the leg off a cow if you just want a couple of cups of tea. It's not, so you have to be able to, although cattle was generally accepted because, you know, most of us like eating from time to time, it was not really a very practical way. So in the end it devolved on the precious metals. So this time, there was another problem as well. Let's assume that you've got the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker in a village. Now, the butcher has got a nice lump of meat, which he wants to sell. The candlestick maker wants a lump of meat to take home this evening. But, of course, the butcher doesn't want candlesticks today, no thank you. This is called a double coincidence of wants in the trade, which is what you've got to have in a barter situation. And you can actually eliminate that by the candlestick maker flogging his candles to somebody quite other than the butcher, getting the money, and then going over to the butcher and say, oh yeah, I'll have that nice pair of pork chops over there. And away you go. And so that's how money evolved. Now, I'm going to come back to labour as a substance of value a little bit later on. But notice that I'm doing something totally different from what we did at the start, where we just said, well, money, it's just conventional, it's just got the Queen's head on it, and we use it to swap stuff about. We're saying, which was also true in Marx's day, and that's, I'm taking you through Marx's stuff, and then we've got to sort of qualify it, that there was commodity money in the 19th century. That if you got a £5 note from the Bank of England, which was the smallest notes that they did, which would have been many, many weeks' wages to most workers. So I imagine most workers would never have seen a Bank of England £5 note in the 19th century. But you could take it in to the Bank of England and get 5 gold sovereigns back. They would only issue a £5 note if there was gold backing in the vaults of the Bank of England. So you were actually talking about commodity money. And despite the fact that, okay, they're actually using paper, because let's face it, that's handier than lumping gold about, that was as good as gold at that time. You could take that £5 back at any time and say, stuff that, I want gold. And because you would say that, and because they have to be able to back every single £5, except for 14 million for some weird reason that I don't fully understand, but it's not very important. Because they had to back it up, it was as good as gold. You know, there were, you would not get them just pumping Mickey Mouse money out to pay their bills, which is a possibility that arises when you get an inconvertible paper currency. And let's go back to value now and have a sort of fictitious development of the exchange relationship. So you get washed onto a desert island, and a couple of other survivors from the wreck get washed onto the desert island. First of all, you pursue your own survival. So you're shinning up coconut trees, grabbing a coconut, down you come. Now, there's going to be... I've never been able to find this quote. I'd like to be able to see it. That Trotsky said, man is a lazy creature. And he was all in favour of it. Because there's you sitting there thinking, oh God, I've got to shin up this coconut tree. It takes me half an hour. And all I get is one sodding coconut out of the whole thing. So therefore, you get a branch and you get a few creepers. Bingo, you've made a primitive ladder, you see, and so you can just run up the ladder, boom, boom, boom. And this is, as you might have noticed, it's a story, but it tries to reflect what has actually happened with the development of human society. The most fundamental thing about the development of human society is the development of the powers of production, that we can make things and get things that we want quicker than we could have a million years ago. And that is progress. That is real progress. Now, who gets the benefit of that progress in a class society is another matter. But it is, genuinely is potentially an enormously progressive thing for human beings, that they can get the things they want with less effort than they could before. So far, they've got these three characters and they've all invented ladders, and they don't have to spend their old time picking coconuts. They can turn their hand to other things. So they decide that what they're going to do is they're going to make root beer. Okay. Now, they're all sitting around drinking their root beer, and they know one evening, and they notice that Fred's root beer is much better than anyone else's. So they say, Fred, got a bright idea. You brew all the root beer, we'll pick your coconuts for you. Thus, exchange is born, you see. Now, the basis, obvious, the question that comes to you, obviously, is how much root beer will exchange for a coconut in this first act of exchange? And the answer is going to be that if it takes you half an hour to pick a coconut and half an hour to brew half a pint of root beer, then half a pint of root beer is going to exchange for one coconut. Because if the bloke who produces the root beer tries to rip you off, or if the man making the picking the coconuts tries to rip you off, then you can just pick your own coconuts or brew your own root beer. And that is not very different from an example that Adam Smith used about people trading deer and beaver, where he said that in one of the first pages of his book, Wealth of Nations, that if it takes an hour to trap a deer and 2 hours to catch a beaver, then the natural rate of exchange is 2 deer equals 1 beaver. And again, the idea is that if the geezer exchanging deer tries to rip you off, you say, sod it, I'm going to get my own deer instead. And it'll only take half the time that he's trying to exchange it for. I'm trying to get you back to the basics of it, but obviously there are one or two complications compared with this primitive state of society that we're looking at. First of all, in terms of picking coconuts with ladders, you have to allow not only the time it takes you to shin up and boom, pick your coconut, but also the time it takes you to make a ladder. And in effect, on the depreciation on the ladder. And so if you're talking about real commodities, they divide into three parts. The first part is that they divide into what Marx called constant capital. So you're going to have to try and work out what is the depreciation on a ladder. Because time spent making a ladder is just the same as time spent climbing up the ladder and picking the coconuts. You've got to include the two to get a realistic picture of how much time you're actually devoting to that activity. But secondly, in a class-divided society, there is one difference. These people own their own means of production. Although they're exchanging, they are simple commodity producers who exchange their commodities among themselves. You have laid claim to this coconut tree. You have appropriated the twigs and the stuff that to make the ladder. They're yours. Nobody can rip you off. The difference with capitalism, obviously, is that they own the means of production, and that therefore we have to work for them. Now, we work for them at what we call a subsistence. Obviously, the subsistence that workers get in the 21st century in an advanced capitalist country is very different from what they got at the time of Charles Dickens. We know that. We're not stupid. We know that the working class has made gains. We're quite proud of the fact, actually, that we're not just being shoved around like Tiny Tim and these sort of people in Dickens stories. It's an advance on the part of the working class. But we haven't got enough that we can just buzz off and retire. If you could go in for 5 years and make enough money that you could run off and buy shares and then sit around and wait for the dividends to pop in, then everyone would try and do it. Now think about it. If everyone was able to do that, it would not happen, because dividends would not plop through people's letterboxes if there's nobody actually in those factories and workplaces making the stuff. Because, okay, capitalism is different these days from Dickens' time. You don't have capitalists owning the mill and with big top hats and that kind of thing. People own shares. When you would say capitalists own the means of production, you mean they own pieces of paper that entitle them to a share of other people's work. That's what owning the means of production means in the 21st century. So those are the three parts that a commodity is divided into. But it is important to just do this basics of labour value. One of the first people who criticised Marx from the standpoint of bourgeois economics was a bloke called Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk, an Austrian economist. And he didn't have a problem that you could exchange the labour of a tailor who made a coat with the labour of spinners and weavers who made 20 yards of linen. But he said, well, what I would need to know is how much for how much. Now, frankly, that is ridiculous. What Marx is saying is this, that there is a miracle taking place here. The labour of a tailor is qualitatively different from the labour of spinners and weavers. It's different skill, they're different people, they're doing completely different tasks. And yet you don't blink. None of us blink when that happens. But this is the central mystery of the capitalist system, actually, is that we're actually part of a huge division of labour. We don't recognise we're part of that division of labour. And we just sort of take it for granted that, oh, well, you know, we can exchange these things. But it is mysterious. And von Bohm-Bawerk was saying, well, the problem is, how can you prove that X amount of the labour of a tailor is equal to Y amount of labour of spinners and weavers? And it's a bit like, I don't know how many people are familiar with Catholic theology, but it's a bit like, you know, the bread and the wine turn into the body and blood of Jesus Christ in the communion. And you say, no, I don't have a problem with that at all. I find that entirely plausible. What I need to know is how much body, how much blood. And that is ridiculous, isn't it? If you accept that completely different types of labour are exchangeable, then you're accepting that there's something the same about them. And that is that they are products not of the labour of a tailor and the labour of a spinner or a weaver, but that these people are part of a huge division of labour, and in fact there's a pool of what Marx called abstract labour, which is being divided up, not in a conscious way. Nobody's saying, you do this, you do the washing. Nobody says that under the washing up. Nobody says that under capitalism, but nevertheless you are imposed into a division of labour. And that's what happens to you. Okay, now get back to money. Money operates, starts off with this isolated act of exchange. When you're saying 20 yards of linen equals one coat, you're using one of those commodities to measure the other. You're using it, in fact, as the first form of money. Money is an equivalent. It's a universal equivalent. It's a universal equivalent for practical reasons. It's a universal equivalent because it arises out of the exchange process, and it acquires that because of these various handy things about it. You can divide it up into discrete lumps that represent certain amounts of values. Everyone will accept it after a certain period of time. So it's a universal equivalent. It's a measure of values. We don't measure value in terms of labour time. No, look, this is a pretty simple thing. What did it cost? 30 or 40 pence, this biro? This biro is mainly made out of plastic. That plastic is mainly oil-based, as I understand it. That oil comes out of the North Sea. I've never seen one of these things, but I understand that the derricks in the North Sea are twice the size of St Paul's Cathedral. A very small amount of the depreciation of one of those derricks contributes something towards the value of this. How much? You can't possibly know. And in any case, why do we need to know? It's absolutely pointless. We're not actually saying, oh, there's X hours of labour in there and Y hours of labour in that. We're saying that, oh, yeah, that's worth twice as much as that because there is twice as much labour in it. Why do houses cost more than fish and chips? Well, you probably work that out for yourself, because it takes much more work to build an house than it does to acquire fish and chips. Why does a box of matches cost less than fish and chips? Well, because let's face it, it's not very elaborate. There's not a lot of labour that goes into the production of a box of matches. So that is the role that money plays in exchanging commodities in the capitalist system. But it plays another role, I think you're all going to be here tomorrow, and that is in relation to a means of payment. In other words, so far we've dealt with exchange. You go into the marketplace, you're a candlestick maker. Somebody buys your candlesticks, you get money. You run off to the bakers or the butchers, and all these exchanges take place at the same time. But of course that doesn't have to take place at all. The other role that money takes is a role of a means of payment. You borrow money you haven't got. We've all done this, I'm sure. You borrow money you haven't got, you spend it for present gratification, and you get the bill comes whomping on your doorstep a bit later on. So I'm not really, unless you want to do a lot about this, to discuss the actual intricacies of the financial system, because it is a whole subject in itself. But the final thing is that I started off with commodity money because I think it's important that you understand that money did begin as commodity money. But of course, it's not commodity money now. If you can go in the Bank of England, wave a £5 note at them and half a gold sovereigns, and they'll just laugh at you. Of course, once that that connection has been broken, then if they send out twice as many pound notes, £5 notes as they did before, then each £5 note is only going to be worth half as much. And you are going to get an inflation taking place. Does that mean that we are monetarists in the sense that Milton Friedman and these people were? Not really. Milton Friedman was a bloke who actually wrote Monetary History of the World. You know, everything in the world happened because of the way the money supply was being manipulated, as if it was just a matter of these authorities who were either benign Friedman supporters or malignant Keynesians and other dodgy sort of characters like that were in charge of the money supply. And that is totally ridiculous. I mean, what we are saying is that when you've got an inflation like you did in the 1970s, which was over 20% a year at one time, at some stage that is because the government is increasing the money supply. But it's not just because the government is evil or they're stupid and short-sighted, it's because the economy has hit real problems. And what we have to do in a situation like that, and it does look like inflation might be coming onto the agenda once again, is to actually look at what those forces are that causes capitalism to come into problems, which in turn leads to there being an excess emission of money. But the main thing to notice is that all these people who talk about money, all the neoclassical economists, whether they're Keynesians or they're Friedmanites and the fairly hard right sort of characters that run the show these days, they all try and present money as being neutral. In neoclassical economics, money is said to be a veil. You know, all you do is you lift the veil and you see these commodities actually moving around among themselves. All that money's doing is hiding what's basically a barter economy. It's not basically a barter economy. You know, money is not neutral. Money plays a role in politics, and people like Milton Friedman were profoundly political people. He went over to Chile after the defeat of Allende. He probably didn't actually put electrodes on people's genitals himself, but he did know that that went on. I mean, the Chicago boys did know that that went on, and their economic shock treatment was part and parcel of a defeat of the working class movement, which took place in Chile at that time. And it was profoundly, monetarism was a profoundly political movement. It was a right-wing reactionary movement against the overmighty strength of the working class, as people like Friedman saw it. So I'll leave it there.